Well, it's hot, it's dry, and that means stress for your plants and for you. But never fear, because Garden Talk is here. I'm Jill Nadeau, and our guest for the next hour is Bruce Spangenberg. Bruce is the statewide horticulture outreach specialist for the UW-Madison Division of Extension, and he also writes the weekly column Yard and Garden. We're going to be talking about wilting plants, lawn problems, and of course, take your questions. So what's causing you stress in your garden? Give us a call with your questions, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Bruce, it's so nice to see you again. Bruce, can you hear me?
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Somebody was muted. We're not going to point any fingers, but. Yeah, it's great to have these, being able to see you face to face, but yeah, we tend to mute ourselves when we're not paying attention. I do that all the time. So thank you for being with us, Bruce. Oh, I think we might have dropped him. Oh, there we go. Sorry, folks. So Bruce, what has the weather been like in Wisconsin, as far as the questions that you've been getting? How is it affecting your job?
Well, you know, up until the last few days, obviously the heat was a big thing. You know, we had, you know, very humid, hot weather, humid weather, but also a lot of wind. So, you know, it's just difficult. Plants dry out fast and they take a beating from the wind as well as the heat. So, that's probably the number one thing. And of course, some areas have gotten a lot of rain on, you know, the last month or so. Some areas have gotten exceptional amounts of rain, which creates issues. But there are still some areas that could use rain. You know, where I'm at here in Price County, overall, it's pretty dry right now. So a whole variety of things, depending on exactly where you're at.
Sure. I was looking at some of your columns, and one of the things that you wrote about that got me really interested was that plant that's looking like it's all wilty, which first thing I would have thought of is like, oh gosh, I've got to water it right away, may not actually be wilting because of lack of water. Tell us what the problem could be.
Yeah, you know, we assume this time of year, plants wilting, and like I mentioned, the hot weather we've had, typically that's the issue. You add some water to the soil and things remedy themselves. But what I stressed in that column, really two issues there. Plants are constantly losing water, and sometimes people say, well, you know, what's the logic behind that? You know, if a plant takes in water, why would it lose it? But it loses water through its leaves. So more water keeps flowing in the plant. It brings in nutrients and everything, you know, is transported within the plant. So what can happen on, you know, a hot, windy day like we've had recently, the water exiting the plant may just be so rapid that the plant simply can't keep up. There might be adequate water in the soil, but it's exiting way faster than it could be replaced. And a lot of times you'll notice, like in the heat of the day, if you've got plants like, you know, squash or pumpkins are excellent examples in a vegetable garden. In the middle of the day, in a hot, sunny afternoon, they're going to be drooping. But then you go back and look at them at night or the next morning, they look fine because they've caught up. You know, the weather's cooled down, it's gotten more humid, that kind of thing. The other issue with water in plants, so I mentioned the transport, you have a network that goes from the roots through the stem to the leaves, what's known as the xylem, which is basically a whole series of hollow tubes that allow the water to move. So if anything happens to disrupt that, you're going to have a plant wilting. So for example, I know you had Brian Huddleston on a few weeks ago, and he talked about wilt diseases, you know, like verticillium, fusarium, oak wilt, Dutch elm disease. Those are all diseases that the fungi actually develop inside that network, in that xylem, and they plug it up so water can't move through. So there's a case where a plant can wilt. It could be a tomato with fusarium. It could be an oak tree with oak wilt. There's plenty of water in the soil, but the tree or the plant is wilting because its network has been disrupted. You know, we have insects that chew on stems or under the bark on trees that can destroy that system. There might be physical injury sometimes, you know, with mowing equipment or an animal chewed on it or something on the stem, and it disrupted that system. So there again, there may be plenty of water in the soil, but you got a problem with the transport network. And the last issue is the root system itself. It sounds odd, but plants can wilt when they get too much water, you know, if they sit in water too long and the roots die off, they're not functioning well. And the plant's wilting because it's not taking in water, even though there's plenty of water in the soil, even an excess amount. It's because the root system has been compromised, doesn't have enough oxygen, so it's declining. So all those things come into play. And that was the point of that column. Think about that. But obviously, the first choice would be check the soil. If it's dry, add water. And hopefully, this time of year, that takes care of the problem.
I had to laugh when you were mentioning about squashes and pumpkins, because I've been fooled by those wilty leaves a number of times. Yeah, they really look like, oh, they're done. They're gone. And then the next day, they're fine. So
yeah,
they do a good job of conserving what they need. Let's go to the phones next. And if you have a question for Bruce, give us a call. He can answer all the topics. So 800-642-1234. Amy and Madison, we'll take your question. Go right ahead.
Hi. I recently had some mulch delivered. And at the end of my 3 yards of mulch, I noticed there were some snake worms in there. And I picked them out and I put them in the trash, but I'm wondering what can we do about snake worms at all, or if we can do anything that's been shown to actually be effective.
Yeah. The issue there, about all you can really do, it'd be, you know, be careful where you get your mulch sources from. And if you do notice that you've got issues, allowing it to dry out will help. Expose it to the sun, maybe spread it in a thin layer and have it out in the sun for quite a bit to dry it out and hopefully help. Heat sometimes can help with some of those issues. But yeah, you can have a lot of potential problems, unfortunately.
And that snake worms are also known as jumping worms, crazy worms. So in case someone thinks we have another kind of worm that's in invading us, it's quite a problem down here in Madison. So you have to be so careful. Same thing when you buy plants. When you get plants from your neighbors. It's a terrible problem. But
jumping worms is the correct term. But yeah, snake worms and all kinds of stuff comes in there as far as terminology. But yeah, you've raised an excellent point. I mean, not only get mulch from reputable sources, but nursery stock, you know, nursery material is inspected. Always get material from licensed nurseries, certified stock. I mean, it's tempting sometimes to share plants with your neighbor, but try to stay away from that. Or sometimes you see, you know, plant sales that come up with garden clubs or church groups or whatever. I mean, the intentions are good, but just be very, very careful. Anytime you're transporting plant material, especially with soil on the roots, you do run that risk of transporting things like jumping worms or diseases is the other reason, insect problems. And that's why nursery stock is inspected on a regular basis.
Yep, absolutely. So keep an eye out, Amy, because if there were a few, there might be more than that. So hopefully you got them, but you never can tell. So thanks for that call. David in New Richmond, how can we help you?
They recently acquired some giant pumpkin seeds and was going to start next year to see what we could do. But my friend cautioned me against there being squash or I think cucumbers nearby, and I was wondering if you could explain that one.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and really the issue is not so much the season you plant. So if you have crops that may cross-pollinate and they're next to each other, the issue becomes the second season if you save the seed. So squash and pumpkins, melons will readily cross-pollinate. So let's say I had cantaloupe in my garden and I had squash right next to it this season. I don't have to worry about the fruit being affected when I harvest it this year. But if I decide, well, this is the best tasting melon I ever had and I'm going to save these seeds and I'm going to plant them next year, very good chance something else pollinated that cantaloupe. Didn't affect the fruit, the flesh that I ate this year. That was the genetics of this year's flower. But the genetics of next year's seed has been changed. So next year I plant that. The plant looks great, produces melons. I harvest that melon, bite into it. It's the worst thing I ever tasted because a squash cross-pollinated it. So the issue is always saving the seeds until next year. That's where you run into the genetic change. It's not an issue the year you plant them. So if you have those seeds now, you can plant them wherever you want next year. Whatever's next to them doesn't matter. Just don't save those seeds for the following year, because that's where you're going to run into problems.
And I'm assuming that if he's growing the giant pumpkins, he wants to make sure they're not contaminated because he wants to save the seeds. Isn't that usually how it works?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and that becomes an issue with seed producers. Sweet corn's another one. You have to be really, really careful with when you have field corn and sweet corn mm-hmm. nearby, because it can alter the quality. So, yeah, seed companies have very tight guidelines and very strict rules they follow when they're trying to produce seed to sell to make sure it's not cross-contaminated with something else.
Okay, so now you know, David, keep those separate if you want to keep those pure. Thanks for the call. If you've got a question, we have open lines, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. It's talk@wpr.org. Jeff in La Crosse, go right ahead with your questions.
Hi. I've got a couple questions about apple trees. I've got three apple trees on the east side of my yard. An older one that's doing really well and has apples every year, and then two newer ones that I put in about 5 or 6 years ago going north from that. One is about 10 feet north of the old one and is growing very well, is a lot of leaves, but only had apples like the first year or two. And then the northmost one replaced an older one that was there that I cut down because it was sprawling and leaning way over. Well, now the new one in that same spot is only about half of the height of the other new one. Doesn't have a lot of leaves, but it does have apples and is also starting to lean over. And I asked the nursery where I bought them at, and they couldn't figure it out. So I'm just trying to figure out what's going on, why the one tree is growing very well, but no apples. And the other one that isn't growing so well does have apples.
Yeah. Couple things. And that question does come up, and some years we see more of that than others. I know a few years back, that question was real common when I was in Iron County. One of the things to think about is the age of the tree. Now, you mentioned a couple of these are replacements. And trees will vary in how quickly they come into bearing after they've been planted. Generally speaking, you know, most of our dwarf grafted trees come into bearing pretty quickly. Some of the old standard trees can take several years before they're actually going to produce fruit on a regular basis. Now, you mentioned the one tree is growing very well. That could be a sign things are too good. Sometimes when you have a lot of high fertility, a lot of nutrients available, you get a lot of vegetative growth, but the tree is slower to start producing flowers. Now, the tree you mentioned that's not doing as well, but it is producing fruit. When apple trees are slightly under stress, and you have to be real careful here not to put them under too much stress, but when they're slightly under stress, they actually produce fruit better. And sometimes that's actually a kind of a trick when you have a tree that's not bearing well to slightly stress it. They used to have a process, it's an old process called scoring, where you very lightly scrape the bark to try to slightly stress that tree to get it to bloom. We kind of hesitate to recommend that much because it's very easy to overdo it and then severely damage the tree. But that tree that's doing real well, be careful not to add any fertilizer. You know, make sure it's watered, obviously, during drought stress, if we get drought. If those trees get shade, that can also hinder flower development. You may get a lot of leaves and not enough flowers. So that could be a case where one's getting more shade than the other. But hopefully that, you know, things will even out over time. You know, 5 to 6 years is still fairly young, you know, as far as the time period from planting to production. But I would expect they would start blooming a little bit more. And some trees you'll get into, they may bear heavy 1 year, and then next year they have very few flowers on it. We call that biennial bearing, and it's hard to really break that other than the year you expect a heavy fruit load. Sometimes if you prune heavily in the spring, that'll help break that cycle a little bit. But some of the older trees have been notorious for doing that, where they're heavy 1 year, and the next year you got almost nothing, and then the year after, you're back with a huge fruit load. So a lot of things come into play there.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, for that question. And we had a yellow delicious tree when I was growing up that did that. One year it was just covered, and the next year we had maybe 20 apples. So, yeah, it's interesting. Dot in Manitowoc, go right ahead with your question, thanks. Hi. Or comment, actually.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon. I learned something new this morning. I was in my garden, and I asked my friend, Tim, if he would apply some water to my gourds, who are, of course, they're dry. And he told me to put some milk in the water, and that will enhance the gourds or their pumpkins. Now, I never heard that before. And what a nice use of, again, of milk. Put it in a gallon and apply it to your gourds and pumpkins.
How much are you watering this milk down, Dot? How much?
I didn't ask him, but you have to start light.
Okay.
Or not light milk particularly, but just ease up to overdoing it, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
Put a little milk in there to start, and as the gourds or the pumpkins really take off, say, oh, I wonder what I did that made them so big. And you'll find out that it was the milk. But like I said, don't overdo it.
Bruce, have you heard of that one before?
No. That's interesting. No, honestly, I have not heard that. You hear a lot of different, you know, things along those lines, a lot of the home remedy kind of things, which a lot of times they're directed toward pests, and we really discourage that because, you know, there's no research behind it. But no, I had not heard about, I'm not sure what's happening there.
Yeah, that's a new one on me, too. Yeah. I would be concerned about smell and attracting animals, all right, Dot, well, you do that and I want you to call me back and tell me if that's made a difference or if it's caused more problems than not, because I want to hear. I'm always interested in hearing these things. So thank you for calling and letting us know. Always interesting. If you've got an interesting story or a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. You know, I walked across my lawn today and it was quite noisy because it's so, so dry. Should we be concerned? Should we be watering, or should we just let nature take its course, Bruce?
Yeah, you have that option. In fact, the column that'll be posted up Monday, I just wrote on kind of establishing priority when you are watering different gardens and lawns and that kind of thing. And it, as far as surviving, lawns are actually pretty low on the list as far as the need to water. And, you know, unless you have a brand new established like sod, for example, but no, lawns can go dormant. You know, we have cool season grasses in Wisconsin, and it's perfectly natural for them to slow down and even go dormant in hot weather and dry weather, and then resume growth when cooler weather and rains come back. The only concern is if it gets to be, you know, a month with no rain, then you start wondering, is that plant going to die? And then you could add just a little bit of water, not enough to keep it or make it green, but just enough to keep it hydrated. Really what you don't want to do when you're watering lawns in the summers, you don't want to wait until they turn brown and then decide to water them to make them green. Because even though they look better, you actually stress them when you do that, because cool season grasses don't actively grow in the heat of the summer. So watering them to make them green up, you're taking energy out of the plant that it's actually going to have a hard time replacing until we get into fall. So if your lawn's already going on the brown side, you're actually better off leaving it that way for the next 3 or 4 weeks. And then, you know, hopefully rains come back and cooler weather comes back once we get into late August and September.
Okay, great. Good to know. So it's not dead. It's dormant, and it's supposed to be
right
that way.
Yeah, I mean, the downside is it's brown, and you might get, potentially you might get a few more weeds, that kind of thing. So those are always trade-offs. But
yeah. Just remember, brown's a color, too.
Exactly. And the other thing you can do is, especially this time of year, mow your lawn very high. That'll help it survive dry weather and warm weather.
I choose not to mow it. It's not growing anyway. What's the point? So, yeah. Okay, Julie in Eau Claire. Oh, we've got something new with the milk. Go right ahead, Julie.
Yes, hi. Well, I've never tried it myself, and I grow pumpkins just the old-fashioned way, but I first read about that in one of Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, and I believe the book was called Farmer Boy, about her husband when he was a boy, and he was growing a pumpkin for the fair. And it was, I don't remember all the details, but I know he fed that pumpkin with a big pan of milk. And, yeah, that goes way back. But I've heard on other garden shows where people have called in about it, and that whoever the expert was, I don't remember, but they said that's really not that much to that. But the fact that they did it back then, you know, they were smart. They must have known something.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. They also put arsenic in clothing. So, you know, there's some things that were good, some things not so much. So thank you, Julie. I love that. So we have precedence. We have precedence, Bruce.
Well, and it's also, it brings up a good point with observation versus research. I mean, sometimes we do things and we see a result that may have been totally caused by something entirely different, but that, you know, the fact is we added something and we saw a result, so we keep doing it, but it's just kind of a coincidence kind of thing. So
yeah,
I'd be a little concerned. I think there's better ways you could fertilize pumpkins, for example, rather than risking, like you say, if you're putting a lot of milk out there, that could be cause some other issues.
Yeah, very true. Very true. I am going to read you an email from Kay in Middleton. She says something is going after her hostas behind the house, and she needs help identifying what's causing the problem. Her house backs into a natural area, so turkeys, rabbits, deer, etc. The damage is most likely occurring at night. Whoever the culprit is, it's chopping off the leaves but not eating them. What can she do to prevent this from reoccurring?
Yeah, most likely it's a mammal of some type. You know, if the leaves are just chopped off and left there, I mean, chipmunks will do that. Squirrels will do that. You know, they're normally going to do that in the day. Rabbits will do that. Deer will also do that. So they may be eating some and dropping some, or, you know, just tasting them or whatever. But the fact that it's night, it's happening at night, I would probably lean toward rabbits or deer. Maybe a chipmunk real early in the morning or late in, you know, right around sundown, you don't notice it. But there's, you know, you can try repellents. That might help a little bit. You know, repellents can reduce damage, but not eliminate it. The only surefire way is to put up fencing of some type, you know, chicken wire or something like that. So there's a physical barrier. The animal can't get at the plant, but now you're looking at the fence. I mean, that's kind of the trade-off. Insect-wise, you know, earwigs feed at night, but they would make holes. They wouldn't leave, you know,
right,
break the leaf
wouldn't
off and
it
drop
off
it on the ground. And the same thing with slugs. Slugs are notorious for getting on hostas, making holes. But go out there at night with a flashlight and see what's there.
Okay. So before we take our quick little break, Dave in Eau Claire called. He said he believes that milk for watering plants can be useful for getting rid of powdery mildew.
Yeah, there again, that's one of those homemade remedy kind of things that I know if you mentioned that to Brian, he would probably frown upon that as well. I mean,
I think he would.
You know, if you want to deal with, avoid synthetic fungicides with powdery mildew, the best thing to do is increase air circulation.
Yeah.
Do those cultural kind of things rather than the homemade remedy kind of things. And it does, you know, present, a lot of times you assume it's a quote, safe product to work with. Obviously milk would be, but you read about things like vinegar and other things that people use, or borax and things that are household materials you assume are quote unquote safe, but they're not. They haven't been tested. They're not labeled as pesticides. And you do run the risk you can damage the plant, or you could damage the soil or something else, even though you think it's a quote unquote safe material. So that's why we stress stick with labeled materials, labeled for disease control, insect control, whatever it is we control, that's along with the cultural practices.
Yeah. Check with an expert. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking to UW Extension statewide horticulture outreach specialist Bruce Spangenberg. We've got all open lines, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. It's talk@wpr.org. Join us again next week on Garden Talk. Melinda Myers is going to be with us, and she'll have recommendations for 10 native plants to put in your backyard. And then in the last half hour, we'll talk about growing irises. But right now, we are taking general questions on gardening, and Bruce Spangenberg is with us. So if you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Kim in Stoughton has a question for us. Bruce, go ahead, Kim.
Hi, I have a pot of petunias. The flowers are looking great, but the leaves are turning like a real pale green, yellow.
Okay, what do you think, Bruce?
Yeah, that's a good question, because right about this time of year with hanging baskets and containers, especially hanging baskets, you know, if you bought that hanging basket back in May, you know, it was already assembled. That was actually planted probably in March in the greenhouse. So those plants are getting older. And obviously in a hanging basket, you have to water more often. So what's happening there is they're running out of nutrients. So what the solution is with hanging baskets, fertilize them. You know, you can get soluble fertilizers. You can mix them right in the sprinkling can and then add those when you're watering the hanging basket. But periodically do that. You know, you can kind of play it by ear with how the foliage is responding. But that pale color is telling you the nitrogen's running out. So fertilize them. You're always better off fertilize on the light side. You can always add more rather than running the risk of over-fertilizing. But they need some nutrients about this time of the year. The other thing you can do to kind of revive them, now we get into the second part of the summer, is pinch them back a little bit. You know, normally a lot of the newer varieties, you don't even have to deadhead anymore like the old ones, but it's not a bad idea to deadhead them, but also just to pinch them back a little bit, get maybe there's some leggy growth there, pinch it back, make it a little more compact, add some fertilizer, and then you're going to notice that kind of rejuvenate themselves over the next few weeks, and you'll get more flowers and better color, not just with the flowers, but also with the foliage.
Yeah, definitely, Kim. And it'll happen quick, too, won't it, Bruce?
Yeah, you'll usually see the response really fast. You know, by the end of the season, those hanging baskets are almost a solid mass of roots, you know, especially if you have several plants that were put in there. So that's why they dry out fast, but also they can run out of nutrients. So keep them watered and add the fertilizer.
Yep, for sure. Thanks for that question. Matthew in Iron River, Michigan. Okay, this is the last call we're going to take with milk. Go ahead.
Okay. Hopefully this settles it then. It's going to depend on your soil and your source of water. Milk has calcium. Roots need some amount of calcium. Too much calcium is not good. If you have compost with eggshells or if you have well water with lime or calcium in it, then you're not going to want to use milk, because if you get too much, it'll stop up the roots and cause more problems than it's going to help with.
Okay. Well, thank you, Matthew. That kind of goes back, Bruce, to making sure you know what kind of soil you have too, right?
Yes, that's one thing we always stress that, but sometimes we overlook it. But periodically testing your soil is a good idea. You know, he alluded to soil pH there. Generally speaking, the southern part of the state, you know, Milwaukee, Madison area, most of the soils, if you're going to guess, they're going to be on the alkaline side, but you don't know without testing them. A lot of them up here in the northern part of the state where I live tend to be more acidic. It's just the nature of the soil and the natural vegetation, that kind of thing. But a soil test would tell you that, and ideally you like to be slightly acidic. You know, 6.6, 6.5, somewhere in there is perfect, because most of your nutrients are available, and the plant's going to respond the best. And when you get extremes, you know, really acidic soil or really alkaline or high pH soils, then you start running into problems with nutrients like calcium and phosphorus and iron and other things react differently. They're still there, but chemically they're different and the plant can't take them up anymore. So keeping track of your soil, making sure that pH is slightly acidic. And then if you need to add things like limestone or sulfur, but don't just add limestone, because that's another thing we hear a lot. People say, well, I wasn't sure what to do, so I added some limestone. Never add limestone unless you've had a soil test so you know what that pH is, because limestone is going to drive the pH up higher. And if you already have an alkaline soil, it's just going to make it worse.
Okay, great. Thank you, Matthew. Richard in Eau Claire, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My tractor guy who cut my lawn 2 cuts ago, left some incredible track marks here and there, and they seem to be dead grass. I can't seem to figure out whether to leave it or try to, you know, cut it up and replace it in these tracks. I heard your comment earlier about the brown grass. This looks pretty dead to me.
Yeah, a couple things that could have happened there. If you mow right, like Jill mentioned, when your lawn starts getting noisy, it's starting to get it on the wilting side, you may notice that the mower tracks are a little more vivid because you're actually crushing some of those leaf blades, some of those crowns. They're not bouncing back because they don't have a lot of water in them. That tends to be fairly temporary because most likely the crown is still alive, but until we get some rain or cooler weather, you're probably not going to see anything changing. More severe than that is if you actually have soil compaction from equipment, and you could have tire tracks. And sometimes that happens in the spring, you know, when a vehicle, for some reason, you know, someone backs off the driveway onto the lawn or something like that, and they make more like a rut where now you've made a depression, you've compacted the soil, which is going to affect the turf. It's going to, you know, look different. It may dry out faster, that kind of thing. That's a little more difficult to remedy. But what I'd suggest at this point, since we're right at the end of July, I'd probably just kind of let it sit for a little bit here and see, you know, depending on how much rain you've had and what the temperatures are, give that grass a chance to kind of bounce back on its own. If, in fact, you have some soil issues, things like core aerating can be done. But there you probably want to wait till we get into September when it gets cooler and you have more moisture in the soil. So for now, just kind of monitor it. There's not a whole lot to do this time of year. And then if need be, start taking some corrective steps when we get into early September. September and October are really good times to aerate soil on lawns. And then if you don't want to aerate, if you just want to use something like a pitchfork on those tracks, you could try that. But generally speaking for lawns, core aerating is an excellent practice that tends to be overlooked, but what it does for your lawn, there's a lot of benefits. It's well worth the effort either to rent a machine or to hire somebody to do it.
Okay. Good luck, Richard. Thank you for the call. Sharon in Janesville, go right ahead with your question.
Hi. Thank you so much. I have a very old but very beautiful aloe plant that has suddenly developed little black spots on many of the leaves. Any ideas?
Oh, Bruce, how's your indoor plant knowledge?
Yeah, I'm kind of drawn. I mean, it's a possibility. It could be insect. It could be disease. It could also just be, typically with houseplants, most of the problems tend to be environmental kind of things rather than a true pest or a true disease. What I'd suggest you do with this one is if you can take some pictures of it, and then we have ask a gardening question on our website. You can submit your question, but you can upload those pictures, and then it'll go to one of our staff members to look at. If we suspect it's a disease, then the next step would be to get that to Brian's disease clinic, you know, Brian Huddleston, who he had on a few weeks ago. If we suspect an insect and we can't identify it, then that would be something for PJ Leash, who's also been on the show numerous times, who has an insect or entomology insect diagnostic clinic available. So first step would be get us a picture. It's hard to say exactly what that spot might be.
And that's the UW extension. So if you just Google UW extension, ask a question, I think it'll probably go right to the spot, won't it?
It probably will, yeah. If you just, you know, the website is hort, H-O-R-T dot extension dot W-I-S-C dot E-D-U, which it's simpler. Just if you just Google Wisconsin extension or Wisconsin extension horticulture, it'll come up. And then you'll see there'll be a, across the top, there's a bunch of stuff listed, and one of them does say resources, and you click on that, you'll see the clinics, but also you'll see ask a gardening question. You can just click on that, and then it's pretty much self-explanatory from there. But getting good pictures, one of us has a chance to look at it, we can get back to you on that.
Yeah, for sure. Pictures are worth, yeah, 1,000 words.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Yeah.
For sure. Well, good luck with that, Sharon, because you don't want the aloe plant to be hurt, for sure. Elizabeth in Verona, you are next. Go ahead.
Hi. My husband was trying to get rid of some weeds in our lawn, and he used a mixture of fertilizer / weed killer, one of those pre-made things. He didn't dilute it enough, and so it burned our grass. It is now, there's lines everywhere from where he sprayed. Do you have any recommendations on how to encourage the grass to grow back once the drought conditions are a little bit more favorable?
I thought you were going to ask for recommendations for a new husband, Elizabeth. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Oh, my gosh. Oh, what can she do? Or what can they do, Bruce?
That, unfortunately, whether, you know, that could be the effect of the fertilizer or the herbicide or both, you know, if they got on a little bit higher concentration. Short term, the remedy, or but all you can really do is add water to that to try to get it, if it's fertilizer, get it diluted, water to help the plant bounce back a little bit. If it's fertilizer burn, typically it'll come back because it probably didn't kill the roots in the crown unless it was really concentrated. Herbicides, it's hit or miss. Sometimes if they're misapplied, you may actually kill the grass, even though it was labeled to use on the grass. But initially add water, you know, give it a few weeks. If we get to be, you know, late in August and there's no sign of anything bouncing back, then you need to look at, you're going to probably have to overseed or reseed some of those areas. And early September would be a good time to do that. And if you've been adding water, you know, given that's a good month away yet, hopefully the fertilizer and the weed killer by then would have been, the effects would have been dissipated. So it wouldn't impact the new grass seed that you put down at that point. But right now I wouldn't try any reseeding or anything. I would just add water and just see how that grass may or may not bounce back.
Yeah, sometimes it'll just fill in by itself. So,
yeah, if it's, you know, bluegrass, that's one of the big advantages. Kentucky bluegrass has rhizomes. So if you have some areas that were burned, the surrounding grass hopefully will have a chance to move in there. The only downside is weeds can also move in there in the short term. But yeah, I would just add water for now and see what happens.
Okay, good luck, Elizabeth. Thank you for the question. So I wanted to talk a little bit about fairy rings. Can you describe them for those who aren't sure what they are and what causes those?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways. And normally the typical fairy ring, what you're dealing with, and there's some history on how those, you know, it was some folklore. That's how that name came about, that they thought it was the work of fairies. But it is true. It is a legitimate problem. It's not just a name we made up. But the most common symptom you see is dark green grass, usually growing faster than the grass around it. And typically it may not be in a perfect circle, but maybe in like a large arc. But it's caused by, there are fungi in the soil that are basically doing their job. They're decomposing organic material, and as they do that, they release nitrogen. So the grass above this fungi in the soil responds by growing. You add nitrogen, grass turns green and it grows, and that ring gradually over time does expand in size. Typically, you know, the classic scenario is there's an old tree stump or tree root system, you know, may have been a wooded area and then it was transformed into turf grass. So there's organic material there that eventually will decompose and disappears. Now, sometimes you'll see in that same ring or arc, you'll see mushrooms. Those are the fruiting bodies of those fungi. In severe cases, and it's more on golf courses, you may actually get a brown arc or brown ring because that basically that fungal growth gets so thick that water can't move through it and the grass above it actually dies. So a variety of things. You can't do a whole lot about it. You know, if it's really thick, you could take something like a pitchfork and kind of try to break it up a little bit and add water to it. But normally just routine fertilizing of lawns within our guidelines kind of masks it. You may see it more in the spring. Sometimes it greens up faster than the grass around it and it tends to disappear as the season goes along. But it's essentially fungi in the soil. They're not attacking your lawn grasses, but the grasses are responding by what these fungi are doing in the soil.
Yeah, and they're kind of cool looking.
Yeah, so. They can be. I mean, there are some cases where they're 50-foot diameter. They can be huge. Normally, they're in that probably 3 to 5, 6 foot range as far as the size.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Amy in Mequon. She has a question about something I wanted to ask you about too. So go right ahead, Amy.
Okay. Thank you. I have a small perennial garden, mostly pollinators, typically native. And a volunteer black walnut sapling has come in there. It's about 6 foot tall now, and so, but it grows really rapidly. In the same perennial garden, I have black-eyed Susans that have totally devastated every single other native pollinator plant that I have, the coneflowers, the bee balm, just on and on. So my question about the black walnut is, it's still a sapling. Do you think I can replant my pollinator garden in that same area? It's kind of on the edge. And how long do I have until that black walnut will affect my vegetable garden about 20 feet away?
Yeah, that I just did a column on black walnut toxicity, but that's a tough issue to deal with, because when we deal with black walnuts, what's happening is they release a chemical that's called juglone that's in their root system. It's in the plant, but it's released by the roots. It's also in the husks of the nuts, and it's in the leaves, and it does inhibit other plants. Now, it doesn't inhibit all plants. So a couple things to think about. If it's a younger tree and your main priority is that perennial pollinator garden, then I would take the tree out. If it's a sapling, I would, dig out as much of the roots as I can and get rid of it. Now, if you want to keep it as a tree and allow it to get bigger, just recognize it will have an impact on a number of plants. Now, the problem is, and I mentioned this in my column, and you'll see the same things if you go online, there's a number of fact sheets out there that talk about black walnut toxicity, and they'll provide lists of plants that are supposedly resistant to black walnut or tolerate black walnut, some that are known to be susceptible. There really aren't any research trials to generate those lists, and in some cases you can hold these, you could have two different lists side by side, and you may have a plant on one list that's listed as being sensitive, and somebody else put it on the list calling it tolerant, because it's all based on observation. So especially if your vegetable garden, I mean, things like tomatoes, potatoes are extremely susceptible to juglone. So my first thought would be, if your first priority is vegetable gardening and perennials and you just have a sapling size walnut, I would get rid of it, dig it out, destroy it, and you're done with it. Now, if you have an established black walnut or you want that walnut to become a shade tree, then you just have to pay close attention to what's there. And it's going to be your own observations on which plants do well and which don't. Also recognize not just the juglone, but as that tree gets bigger and there's more shade, you're going to have some of your shade now impacting the plant that's currently in full sun. 10 years from now, it's going to be in the shade and it may decline regardless of what kind of tree it is. So it's a tough issue to deal with. If you're trying to grow vegetables around black walnuts, even if cut, and I mentioned this in the column, the remedy is not to cut an established huge black walnut down, value it as a shade tree, but recognize those roots are going to stay in the soil for a long period of time. So the remedy, if you're growing vegetables near a black walnut root zone, try things like raised beds so you don't have the soil that the black walnut root is growing in or was growing in where your vegetables are. Try to keep them separate, or just keep your vegetable garden as far away as you can. But you're concerned with at least the drip line, which is the distance the branches go out, going down under the on the soil, and most likely beyond that. And you recognize the tree is going to grow with time. So, it's a tough one, but there are some plants that will do just fine. So it's kind of a hit or miss type thing there.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Bruce. And thank you for the question, Amy. Having lived with black walnuts, I would come down on taking that tree out and really digging it up, because even if you just cut it off at the base, it will keep growing year after year after year. So, experience here. So we've got some emails. Let's take some of those. Cindy in De Pere says a neighbor of hers wants to put rotting banana peels in her garden to enrich the soil, but Cindy worries that would attract rodents. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not just banana peels, but other things you read about. The best way to deal with those is compost them first and then put them out in the garden. And be careful with composting with any kind of kitchen scraps and banana peels included, because it may attract, even in the compost pile, you may get raccoons and who knows what else coming in there. So, the best compost materials are generally, leaves, from plants that are growing outside. But it's not to say, you know, kitchen scraps like the leaves from carrots, that kind of thing, or excess lettuce, that type of thing, that'll decompose pretty quick. Your best bet is to shred it and compost it and then put it in the garden rather than taking something like a banana peel and putting it right in the soil.
Yeah. Okay. Randy emailed to say that this time of year, her flower beds are overtaken by giant spiders and spider webs. Besides knocking them down, is there a natural or non-toxic recommended spray safe for pollinators and pets?
No, not really. I mean, that's it's kind of the thing. You know, spiders overall are beneficial. You know, they're going to catch a variety of insects, including pest insects. But I think, you know, if you really just you're overrun with them or you don't want to have the webs there, probably the best advice would just be a stream of water, you know, just to knock the web down. If you're persistent, that spider may move on and go someplace else. But, you know, as far as any kind of spray, no, we would not recommend spraying for spiders outside like that.
And could it be just because we haven't had a lot of rain that we just notice them more because they haven't been knocked down?
It could be, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you'll see some, even like you see the balloon spider kind of things on lawns where overnight this web appears on your lawn. Yeah. You know, it's maybe a foot diameter or so. And then, like you say, with rain and just activity, it disappears.
Yeah. Okay, one last one here. Michael emailed to say that he has a peony bush between 10 and 20 years old that was always very large with 80 to 90 blooms on it. And last year it had fewer blooms and did not get as tall, and it turned yellow-green. And this year it's even shorter with yellowish leaves, and they have veins that are a bit darker green. It is on the end of a row of about 10 pretty old large peony bushes, and there is space between it and the last bush. Do you have any advice for him?
Yeah, a couple things. You know, if it's an older plant like that, it's kind of extreme symptoms, but that could be telling you it needs to be divided. Hopefully nothing else has happened there, you know, as far as any kind of a chemical or something that got put in the soil or any kind of a root rot. But I think the first suggestion would be on an older, usually what you'll see in an older peony and some of the other perennials, they tend to get smaller, like he mentions there. They may not flower as much. And the remedy typically is to divide them. And then as you divide them, you dig up, you'll see, you know, that fleshy, I think technically it's actually a rhizome on a peony, but that fleshy structure there, you may notice some that's off color, may look unhealthy. You know, cut that apart, discard the stuff that doesn't look well, and then the sound pieces, put them back in the ground, and very good chance you'll revive those peonies. But that would be my first guess, that it's just time to divide them. The other possibility, you know, if it is some kind of a wilt disease or something, or crown rot, there again, if you carefully dug, you may notice discoloration and rot, or you may notice some slimy consistency. There again, you could discard it. You might want to consider, if you mentioned he's got other peonies there, you might want to consider that sending it on to Brian at the Plant Disease Clinic to see if it is, in fact, some kind of disease and maybe there's some other remedy. But typically in those scenarios, the remedy is discard the infected tissue, divide the plant, and replant the healthy, sound tissue.
And be careful about planting them. Depth matters, right?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
You'll have the eyes in there, and I think the guideline, I think it's an inch or an inch and a half maximum.
Yeah, very, very shallow. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being with us again. I'm sure we'll have this conversation again soon. Thanks.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
We've been talking to UW Extension statewide horticulture outreach specialist, Bruce Spangenberg. I'm Jill Nadeau. I want to thank Jeff Robbins for being on the board today and Joel Patnut for being on the phones. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back again next week with Melinda Myers. So please make sure that you tune in then. And we'll also be talking about growing irises. So hopefully we'll have lots of info for you. Please join us.